A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations and institutions. Today, I'll chat with actor, theater director, and author Simon Callow. Back in 2013, he created a one-man stage presentation about composer Richard Wagner in honor of Wagner's bicentennial. And now he's adapted it in a book entitled Being Wagner. I'll speak with Callow about the discoveries he made about Wagner and his sometimes belligerent, often capricious personality, as well as how the composer's darker side, particularly his focus on anti-Semitism, has colored the way his music is received. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The Metropolitan Opera has formally fired former music director James Levine, claiming an internal investigation concluded that allegations of sexual misconduct were credible. In its statement, the Met said that following its three-month investigation into accusations that Levine had engaged in sexually abusive and harassing conduct before and during the time he worked at the Met, it would be, quote, inappropriate and impossible for Levine to continue working at the Met. In turn, the maestro has filed a lawsuit against the Met on the grounds of breach of contract and defamation, and demanding that the salary promised him upon being named music director emeritus be restored. The New York Times reported that Levine is seeking more than $5.8 million in damages, and that the lawsuit claims that Met General Director Peter Gelb is using the current social discussions surrounding the Me Too movement that focuses attention on sexual discrimination and harassment in order to cut the Met's ties with Levine. According to the Times, the Met has denied the allegations in the suit. Members of Austin's music community are mourning the loss of a young double bass player who was one of the victims of three bombings this month that have killed two people and left another seriously injured. According to the Austin American Statesman, 17-year-old Drayon Mason, principal bassist in the Austin Youth Orchestra, was killed and his mother injured in the explosion of a package bomb left at their home March 12th. According to the paper, Mason had been accepted to the University of Texas Butler School of Music. The other two bombings killed one man and critically injured another woman. Police are searching for answers to the bombings, including whether they were connected and possibly racially motivated. MacArthur Theater, the American Repertory Ballet, and New Jersey Symphony Orchestra are among this year's winners in the annual Jersey Arts People's Choice Awards. MacArthur was chosen as the favorite large theater to see a play, the NJSO received the nod in the Favorite Symphony Orchestra category, and the ARB was tapped in the Favorite Ballet Company category. Other winners included Grounds for Sculpture in Hamilton as Favorite Arts Museum, the Arts Council of Princeton as Favorite Art Gallery, and Princeton Summer Theater as Favorite Small Theater. A full list can be found at jerseyarts.com/peopleschoice. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. It's not unusual for an examination of great composers' lives to include some commentary on their personalities. And as great artistic geniuses, adjectives like challenging, headstrong, and contradictory often make the list. But perhaps few composers have received such close scrutiny as Richard Wagner, whose revolutionary tendencies in life and in music, along with a strong undercurrent of anti-Semitism, often seem to define his legacy as much as his music. It was that mindset that actor, musician, theater director, and author Simon Callow set out to explore when he was asked by the Royal Opera House to put together a one-man show on Wagner, presented in 2013 as part of events to mark the bicentennial of Wagner's birth. Although he had loved Wagner's music since his teen years, Callow found himself discovering new aspects of Wagner's personality and character. He's put these thoughts together now in a book entitled Being Wagner, The Story of the Most Provocative Composer Who Ever Lived, published in the U.S. by Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. This was not the first time Callow has channeled a composer. His early career was boosted by his portrayal of Mozart in the original stage production of Peter Schaffer's Amadeus. Later, he would play the role of the impresario Emanuel Schikaneder in the movie adaptation. With discussions of the personalities and actions of celebrities so much in focus in today's popular and social discourse, the premise of Kallo's book seemed very timely. I spoke with him recently about this exploration of Wagner's mindset, personality, and character, how that impacted Wagner's interactions, and how they continue to influence the way Wagner's works are perceived today.
The Royal Opera House in Covent Garden invited me to create a show which celebrated or explored or in some way made theatrical matter out of the bicentenaries of both Wagner and Verdi, as you know, born in the same year, 1813. And I reeled at the idea of it. It seemed almost impossible to me to combine these two giants who were so utterly different in character and in music and in the trajectory of their lives. However, I went away diligently and I read as much as I could get my hands on, and it was perfectly evident to me that the person that one had to make a show about was Wagner, not Verdi, because it's an extraordinary life. It's quite apart from the astonishing, truly titanic musical achievement. The life is almost unbelievably full of incident, from being involved in riots as a young man, being involved in revolution as a mature man, building his own opera house, his extraordinary relationship with King Ludwig II of Bavaria. I mean, it's an astonishing, utterly astonishing life, and he was an utterly unprecedented human being. Thank God, many people might say that there was only one of him. So I presented all that to the opera house and said I wasn't at all sure what form the show would take. I said at the end of having spoken for an hour and a half, and they said, well, you've just actually done it now because you've talked about your discovery of Wagner, and that's probably what it should be about, and that's what it was. Not too first person, but it was evident from the way that I did it that I was in a state of perpetual astonishment at the iniquities of Wagner and at the sublimities of him, and that's really how it evolved, and I think that's how it was. It was quite music and light and projection intensive. The show, it was sort of immersive. It was in its own tiny little way a gesamt Kunstwerk, and it was, I think, I hope, quite Wagnerian in feeling. So that was my starting point with Wagner. I mean, I had been utterly bewitched by him, by his music, more than his personality. I didn't know much about his personality when I first encountered his music when I was, 11, 12 or something like that. I just listened and listened and listened with ever increasing astonishment and wonder. And I became a bit of a Wagnerian. I was a buff. As a 18-year-old, I could have described to you the plots and the detail of every opera and the meaning of it. I could even identify for you a few leitmotifs and things of that sort, all self-taught, you know. I was a bit obsessed by Wagner, I have to say. And then as I grew older, I was less obsessed by him, having discovered a bit more about him. But I tell you the truth, but by the time the Opera House asked me to rate the show, I knew a fraction of what his life had been like. It was a culmination of something. And only a couple of years before, a friend had taken me to Bayreuth, which had certainly focused my mind very strongly on what Wagner was, who he was, what his position in German culture, world culture, the intellectual history of the West was. Those questions had started to pose themselves in my mind. But it wasn't until the amount of books that there are on Wagner is just so terrifying. I did make a pretty good inroad into many of them, but I couldn't pretend to have read the entire literature. I don't think anybody could.
As you said, there is certainly so much already written then. How did you then decide you wanted to take the stage presentation, that next step, and write this book?
A very distinguished British publisher called George Weidenfeld, of Weidenfeld and Nicholson, famously supportive of Bayreuth, even though He's also staunchly supportive of the state of Israel and deeply immersed in Jewish charities and organizations. But that didn't seem to be an obstacle to George. He just thought the music was just absolutely indispensable and glorious. George dropped me a card which carried the astonishing message that he thought this was the closest he'd ever seen the show, was the closest he'd ever come to Wagner the man. And he wondered whether I'd like to write a book about Wagner. Unfortunately, George, by that time, was very elderly and a little prone to go round London offering people book deals. Once we phoned the publishers and said, George has said he wanted me to write a book about Wagner, they said, oh, God, this is so embarrassing. We've already got two books about Wagner coming out this year, so there's no way we can commission another. So sorry. And so I went to another publisher of mine for whom I'd written a book about the short life of Dickens, and it fitted very well into their program, which is I was only ever going to write a short about her partner, my task being to make him as vivid as a human being as I possibly could. And of course that meant writing about his musical achievements and his musical crusades and journeys. But I didn't was never going to set myself forward as a musicologist, but I am not. My task was to give you a sense of what it was like to be around Wagner, and possibly also what it was like to be Wagner, you know, hence the title. So that was my modest ambition in writing the book, and it was basically thanks to George. In fact, I owe a lot to George because it was George's tickets that I used when I went to Bayreuth the first time. A friend of his had been given these tickets by George, and he in turn gave one to me. And so, in a way, I do the book does come out of George's my relationship with George.
Now, did your thoughts and attitudes about Wagner change as you went through this process in writing the book?
Yes, certainly. I was, as anybody who encounters Wagner, I was astonished by how badly he behaved in so many ways and on so many occasions. I also, for the first time, took a deeply unwholesome dive into his anti-Semitism, which is a source of still not exactly bewilderment to me, but I mean, I think I hope I've traced a little bit what his intellectual position about Judaism was. It's an extremely shabby position, but it is a position nonetheless. But the actual day-by-day manifestation of his anti-Semitism, just extraordinary and in a way almost incomprehensible, because no normal human being would behave in the ways that he did. Namely, surrounding himself with Jewish musicians and colleagues, and yet being possessed, sometimes it seemed like a real possession, a sort of diabolical possession, with just this torrent of dislike and rejection of Judaism. Quite uncommon. I think it's almost like a psychiatric condition. He was being painted once by Renoir. And they were having a most amiable conversation as he sat for the painter, amiable. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, something clicked in his brain and he started a torrent of racial abuse. And as soon as it had started, it stopped. And then he resumed being extremely affable and full of anecdotes and so on. And Renoir was shaken. He couldn't understand where it had come from, like a sort of summer storm. It had suddenly descended on Wagner, and then it went. It's just very, very odd. Anyway, so there was all of that. That was a bit of a surprise to me. But the other surprise was how incredibly carefully and loyally Wagner nurtured his genius. Because, as you know, he was pretty well self-taught as a musician. And at the beginning, he showed very little signs of brilliance. He was by no means precocious. He sort of taught himself to write by imitating other composers, which is a very good technique, actually, and always knew that he had within him something extraordinary. He was going to write something titanic and remarkable, and he was going to change the face of music because he insisted it had to be changed as it had become so trivial and insignificant. And he did did exactly what he set out to do, and some. I mean, he created monuments in sound, the like of which had never been really been created before or since. And I was just fascinated by how, through all his bad behavior, he was, as it were, in secret communion with his inspiration, and he just knew it would take its own time. It could only happen when it happened, and when it did happen, he was ready for it and able to write these massive pieces, every single one of them, massive. I mean, we think of The Ring, but the Meistersinger of Nuremberg is an incredible edifice of sound and drama. Amazing. So those twin things, more or less opposed things, were what struck me.
As you mentioned, when people hear Wagner, more so than I think any other composer, one of the first things they think about is the moral, ethical, the anti-Semitism side, in terms of how his beliefs now color the way people to this day judge. Do we play Wagner? Do I like Wagner? Yeah. And it was interesting because, of course, all this comes out now at the time as suddenly now more allegations are coming out about either past historical figures or current artists. There is so much more current focus now on should their actions reflect or be reflected in how I appreciate and how we hold on to their heritage or the legacy. Do you see Wagner as kind of an early example of this, or does Wagner really just stand on his own as his own situation?
I don't think it's a new thing in the history of the human race. I mean, some of the most beautiful things have been created by some of the most impossible people in the most impossible circumstances, you know? In fact, I think the story is slightly discredited, but it was for a long time said that the architect of the Taj Mahal had his eyes put out by Shah Jahan, who commissioned the building so as he would never create anything as beautiful again to anyone else. Now, so one can't really look at the Taj Mahal without thinking of that, but where does it lead you? I don't know. You know, the Taj Mahal is still a very beautiful building, but because of the horrible circumstances of its being brought into existence, should it be pulled down? I think not. You know, many artists have behaved shockingly, despicably in their private lives from as early as we know. You know, I mean, from Roman times forward. There's an example in recent English history of Eric Gill, the great typographer and sculptor and graphic artist, who's created, for example, the BBC building in London, is embellished by him in the most beautiful way, the wonderful aerial and Prospero front of Broadcasting House in London makes it one of the most perfect public buildings we have. And we now know that he was serially abusing his own children, even animals. I mean, he was a monster, no question about it. But do we pull Broadcasting House down? I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Some critics have had some harsh words for the book in terms of either some inaccuracies or particularly the emphasis on anti-Semitism. How have you viewed the responses, again, particularly with regards to the emphasis that you've placed on that aspect of Wagner the man?
I haven't read all the reviews. Absolutely expected that Wagnerian specialists would take issue with one thing or another. Of course, that's what Wagnerians do all the time. They're in a constant state of rage with each other. So I didn't expect I'd be let off the hook on that level. There are a couple of inaccuracies in the book which have been corrected for the second edition. There are very few factual books that don't have errors. So I don't take that very too much to heart. The biggest criticism of the book, which I sort of acknowledge, is that because I deliberately avoided talking about music, there's a bit of a, well, I mean, inevitably I'm focusing on him simply as a man. That is essentially what I'm doing, although it's impossible to separate the man and the music, the man and his achievement in writing music. So I had to steer a pretty difficult course, in a way, and I couldn't fail to acknowledge the music and what he was doing. I tried to give the intellectual background to why he did what he did. But my purpose was always to focus on the way people experienced Wagner, what it was like to be around him, as I said before. What would it be like, for example, to have supper with Richard Wagner? That interests me very much. You may say that that's not a properly, rigorously academic objective, but who's to tell me what kind of book I'm to write? I mean, you want a certain kind of a book about Wagner, then write it yourself. This is the book I wanted to write about Wagner. It's based, rooted in the witnesses, people who were around him, all of whom, or many, many of whom, wrote about him. More than many other, much more than Verdi, for example. Wagner's contemporaries, either appalled or absolutely enraptured by him, or a combination of the two. I mean, from going from one to the other, like Nietzsche or various other of his colleagues, Wagner's colleagues, did begin by being completely entranced by him and ended up by regarding him as devil incarnate and a very bad thing in musical history as well, as Nietzsche's point of view, certainly. So I stand absolutely by the book. I don't feel any need to defend what I've done, which is to give you as vivid a sense as I can of his historical journey, his context, but above all, the actual experience of knowing him, seeing him, listening to him. And I did draw to a large extent, or to an extent anyway, on his autobiography, while acknowledging absolutely that it is full of inaccuracies. But I've always been of the view that what people write about themselves is fantastically illuminating, whether it's accurate or not. That's the way they see themselves. I mean, I've spent a lot of my life writing about Orson Welles, and Orson Welles also fabricated a great deal of his own history. But why? And what was it that he actually said about himself? Why did he say that about himself and not something else about himself? That's interesting. That's an important matter for the biographer. You can't just say, oh, no, he wasn't there when he said he was, or that happened, you know, 2 years earlier, or that didn't happen. So was it, why was he doing it? Not just out of faulty memory. There's a reason for all these things.
At one point, you had referred to Wagner as perhaps kind of the James Dean of his generation, among other characteristics.
Just to be very clear about that, what I said was he saw himself in the way James Dean saw himself. So what I was trying to suggest was that as a teenager, he saw himself as a sort of loner, the bearer of a great deal of angst, was always trying to engage with the truth and despising bourgeois behavior and so on. That was my lesson. I don't know why so many people seem to be rather shocked by my mentioning James Dean, but that, I think it's as vivid a way as you can say what I just said.
Where would you see him, if he were here today, where would you see him residing or being on the art scene?
Being Wagner, he would have created his own space, whatever it was, you know. I could absolutely imagine Richard Wagner, for example, running a film studio of his own, deciding that film was the way that you would reach people best, and therefore creating a studio of his own. Whatever it is that he did, he would have created his own particular version of it, his own context. He would have invented a structure which enabled him to do what he wanted to do. He knew from the beginning that he would never fit in with the pre-existing structures. But therefore, the exact opposite of Verdi, who worked precisely within the limitations of Italian opera in his day, just seeking to improve it from within. Wagner, on the contrary, wanted to raise all the opera houses and build his own temple, a temple sort of to himself, but also to his art, and to ensure that his art was properly performed, that it reached people the way it should do. So wherever he was in the art world, he wouldn't, for example, be at the Metropolitan Opera House of the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden. He would have built some astonishing new building. He would have, as he did, revolutionized acoustics and the relationship of the audience to the work. That's what he was always aiming at. But also, you have to remember that it's hard to remember this all the time. The idealism at the center of Wagner's project is very much, or was anyway, until he encountered the work of Schopenhauer, was very much along a kind of anarchistic lines, which is that he wanted society to be liberated from all the rules and the structures and above all, the concentration of power in the hands of a few people and the money in the hands of a few people. He wanted to cut through all that and eliminate all of that. He was appalled after the first Bayreuth season to realize that most of the audience were just rich people. It was awful to him. He hated it. He thought he'd completely failed because of that. So there is a deep idealism. It's unfortunate, an idealism that you can see could easily tip over into something akin to the dictatorships of the popular dictatorships of the 20th century, the populist dictatorships of the 20th century. Of course, Bayreuth came quite late in his life. If he managed to start earlier and had the resources to do it earlier, he would have gone even further down the line of the scenic reform and the reform of acting within his opera houses and the nature of the buildings, all that kind of thing. That's the territory that he'd be in. I think he would have instantly latched onto the new technology, instantly got the point of that. You haven't mentioned the fact that also completely surprised me is that Wagner was often very funny, genuinely funny. People found him most amusing, not in a cruel or an unpleasant way. He was could be very droll. The thing about him is that his mood switches were just, terrifyingly swift. And he could be roaring with laughter 1 minute and then stab you in the eye the next. He was mercurial, let's put it this way, as mercurial as a human being could be, and could be both tender and funny and thoughtful and compassionate 20 seconds after being gross and coarse and brutal and dismissive of his fellow human beings. So there you have him. Nothing less than contradictory at all times.
That was actor, theater director, and author Simon Callow. His latest book is entitled Being Wagner and was published by Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. More information is available at vintagebooks.com, and Callow's website can be found at simoncallow.com. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you on A Tempo each week, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges of the arts world. Remember, though, that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.